org. Under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at wpfwfm.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
I'm Kamaya.
I'm Amira.
I'm Kaya.
I'm Kamaya.
And you're listening to WPFW Washington.
Another man done gone. Another man done gone from the county. From another man done gone.
Huh? I don't know. What? I'm just going to walk the street.
Shut your mouth.
Oh, no. What'd I do?
Turn around, turn around. Let's go.
A jury of your peers having found you guilty, 10 years.
What? Come on.
I was in jail too, man. It's cold-blooded in the jail. You go down there looking for justice, that's what you find, just us.
Welcome to another edition of Crossroads Today. Now here's your host, Roach Brown.
Good morning, and welcome to Crossroads. This is Roach Brown and Mertine Brown, and we come to you every Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. We've been doing this for 16 years, and I'm only 12, so this, you do the math. We always open up our show with what we call the grapevine, and this is an interesting show. It's the number one topics going on all across the country. The state of affordable housing in Washington, in the country, and especially in Washington, D.C. We have a housing crisis within a crisis. So we have two gentlemen who's very knowledgeable and on the front line of this particular problem, and we'll get to them. But first, we open up with what we call the grapevine, information that you can use. Our co-host, Nikechi Taifa, will not be joining us this morning. She's on her way to the United Nations for a summit of the future of the UN, and Nikechi is all over the place. So good luck to you, Nikechi, in New York City for this summit of the future of the UN. Now we start with what we call the grapevine. U.S. public schools banned 10,000 books in most recent academic year. More than 10,000 books were banned in U.S. public schools from 2023 to 24, according to a report making a stark increase over the year before as Republican-led states passed new censorship laws. The survey from Penn American suggests that bans of book nearly tripled nationwide from 3,362 the previous year. At least 13 titles were banned for the first time, including Alex Haley's Roots, the saga of American family, which describes the journey of an enslaved person from Africa to the U.S., and James Baldwin's Go Tell It on a Mountain, the acclaimed semi-autobiographical work set in Harlem, New York. Our co-host, Nikechi, has written several books, and her book has been banned. There's 50,000 books that are banned in prisons and jails and correction facilities in America. 50,000. So this issue is something that really needs to be addressed. And Nikechi, our co-host, her book is about Black kids, and her book is banned. There's some prisons that ban the Bible, saying there's too much violence and sex in the Bible. So this is the issue that we'll stay on top of. New York Police Department brass refusing to punish officers who commit stop and frisk abuses, says comprehensive court order report. The New York Police Department systematically refuses to discipline officers who conduct illegal stops and frisks, according to a new report. The epidemic impunity starts with commissioners who have repeatedly rejected recommendations to discipline officers confirmed to have committed abuses. The 503-page court order report is the most comprehensive review of discipline for such violations since 2013. Surviving extreme heat in prisons. Incarcerated journalists detail the first signs of a heat wave in prison and how they have coped with record-breaking temperatures. Several courts have ruled that extreme temperatures in prisons violate the Eighth Amendment provision against cruel and unusual punishment. But these rulings have not led to a widespread adoption of air conditioning or other methods to cool prison facilities or prevent heat-related deaths. Public health researchers at Brown University estimate that just one day of above-average summer temperatures is associated with nearly 4% increase in prison deaths. Suicide spiked 23% in the 3 days following the heat wave. And for every 10 degrees above the average summer temperature, prison deaths increased 5%. The seemingly endless cycle of reforms in juvenile justice. As Ohio considers closing youth detention facilities, recent efforts in other states have hit roadblocks. On Tuesday, Governor Mike DeWine announced that the state would try to shut down its three large youth correctional facilities in favor of building smaller and less centralized units. DeWine cited findings that young people do not respond well to adult-style incarceration. Ain't that something? The working group was assembled after a month-long investigation into Ohio's juvenile justice system by several local newspapers. The investigation found that youth in the system were routinely victims of violence and neglect, and that employees of the facility faced chronic understaffing and threats to their safety. Instead of receiving rehabilitation and support, many of these young people left the system with trauma that exacerbated behavior issues. Teens who enter the system have a 40% likelihood of winding back in custody and face a disproportionate chance of dying an early and violent death. Hundreds sue over alleged sexual abuse in Illinois' youth detention center. More than 200 people in three lawsuits detail abuse for decades. More than 200 men and women were sexually abused as children while in custody at juvenile detention centers in Illinois, according to a lawsuit filed on Monday. The latest in a string of complaints alleging decades of systemic child sex abuse. Three lawsuits filed on Monday detailed abuse from 1996 to 2021, including rape, forced oral sex, beatings by correction officers and nurses, kitchen staff, chaplains, and others. The state of Illinois has caused and permitted a culture of sexual abuse to flourish unabated in its Illinois Youth Center facilities, one lawsuit said, adding that Illinois had overwhelmingly failed to investigate complaints, report abusive staff, or protect young inmates. That has been what we call the grapevine, information that you can use, the grapevine. Now we get to our topic for this morning is the housing crisis in D.C., which is identical, similar to what's happening all over the country. And everywhere we turn, we find folk who are having problems finding housing. It's no secret that affordable housing is increasingly difficult to come by in the United States for both home buyers and renters. In preparing our joint study we learned that housing insecurity is much worse than we thought. Good morning, gentlemen. Our two guests this morning are from Miriam's Kitchen. We have Andrew Wasinich and Dana White. Dana is a director of advocacy for Miriam's Kitchen, and Andy Wasinich is a director of policy. Andy, can you start off and give us a brief overview of what Miriam's Kitchen is, please?
Sure thing. Miriam's Kitchen is a homeless services provider that we were founded in 1983, initially basically as a soup kitchen that served breakfast every morning on weekdays, Monday through Friday, initially founded by with cooperation of four congregations, three churches, and a synagogue. And today we're an independent agency, and we have grown. So over the years, we expanded our services, added a dinner program, added case management, added art therapy, added a permanent supportive housing team. So we are one of the couple dozen providers in the city that provide case management with people who are connected to permanent supportive housing vouchers. About 7 years ago or 8 years ago, we started an outreach team. We are one of three providers that are part of the Comprehensive Street Outreach Network, providing homeless street outreach to the city. Our team covers a little bit less than half of the total area of the city, 33 square miles. And we have all of Ward 1, all of Ward 4, all of Ward 3, and the vast majority of the area that is Ward 2 in the National Mall. And we have an advocacy team as well that started. And so we are among the leaders in Washington, D.C., advocating for better programs and more robust programs and funding for housing vouchers to end chronic homelessness in Washington, D.C. And indeed, that is our mission, to end veteran and chronic homelessness in Washington.
Okay. And Dana White, you're the director of policy of Miriam's. I'm sorry, director of policy advocacy. See, I get things twisted, man. I ain't woke up yet. Okay. All right, Dana, can you give us a little brief thing of what your job is as director of advocacy for Miriam's Kitchen, please?
Sure. So as Andy was saying just a moment ago, our mission, well, the mission of our advocacy team at Miriam's Kitchen through the Way Home campaign, which is a campaign that we launched, it's really a coalition of around 110 organizations and 7,000 individuals in D.C. who are committed to ending chronic homelessness here in the district. And when we refer to chronic homelessness, we're talking about persistent or repeat homelessness experienced over a year, sometimes, you know, decades. There are people who have lived on our streets in D.C. for, you know, upwards of 10, 20 years. And so we're committed to ending the crisis of chronic homelessness as it impacts single individuals. There are two really distinct homelessness response systems in D.C., one that serves families, the other that serves individuals. And unfortunately, historically and persistently, the individuals who are experiencing homelessness on our streets are under-resourced. They're just not getting the investment that they need to end homelessness. So,
okay. As we drive through the streets of Washington, D.C., we go to other cities, New York, L.A., and New Orleans, my wife and I, and everywhere we go, we see homelessness. We see people living on the streets. We've been working on here on Crossroads. We deal with the returning citizens and those incarcerated and the people just come home. And the problem is off the chain. We got guys who did 30, 40, 50 years who came out of prison, and the entire family has died. They have nobody in the street that... the house that they grew up in is no longer there. It might be a high, a freeway, it might be an apartment, whatever. Another structure has been erected in that facility, in that space. And we got folks, man, who come out after 30, 40, 50 years, don't know how to navigate the system, they don't have a place to stay. And they call us here at the station. And we call folks like you, Andrew and Dana, for assistance. How pervasive, how bad is this problem, man, about homelessness for men and women coming out of prison, even for youth? We got a lot of youth that is not even being discussed. The homeless problem for youth is off the chain. Either one of y'all can attack one or both of the questions. Guys, I see you smiling, Dana. Come on with it, you turkey.
It's a big question. It's a big question. Yeah, it's a crisis. It's not just a crisis of housing affordability, like you said, but it's a homelessness crisis that has persisted in D.C. for generations, really. It definitely impacts folks who are being released from incarceration. There aren't a lot of, a lot of follow through with getting those folks housed. There are really unique barriers to those folks finding housing. And I really appreciate that you mentioned how the crisis impacts young people, particularly young people under 30, especially those who are Black or LGBTQ. Identified. There's really a lack of resources there. There's a lack of housing resources there. And the affordability crisis is really impacting young people, I would say most.
Mm. All right, Andrew, you want to chime in?
Yeah, I mean, I would follow up. Like, so before I started in this position, I was on our outreach team for 7.5 years. And I can say that, like, encountering individuals who are recently released from jail or prison is something that happens on a regular basis, and it's a real problem, that needs to be addressed, through the Department of Corrections, like both locally and nationally. Like, it's just a problem that we expect people to just return to, we just let them go. Okay, you have your freedom, you're on your own. Like, there's just nothing for anybody, like nothing set up to help them succeed. And then we, turn around and wonder why like rates of recidivism are so high, but we're not, if we wanted to really help people and keep people from going back to jail, then we would have programs in place to help them succeed. We you know, my team, the outreach team, and our dining room is set up. Like, you know, we've helped, you know, lots and lots of people who, you know, came out of the criminal justice system to find housing. But like, there's no, in some ways, they either found us or somebody referred them, or, you know, they kind of got lucky. Like, there's like nobody points them where to go. Like, they don't say like, oh, go to Miriam's Kitchen or go to this organization for help. And, you know, it's just really interesting that a lot of times also probation officers and things like that, they have really no clue or knowledge of the homeless services system itself, and they don't really know where to direct their own people like to solve the problem.
Let me ask you, what impact has gentrification played on this issue about homelessness or on affordability of housing in our city? Has gentrification played a role, or what role did you see it play? Because I know a lot of neighborhoods that guys have grown up in, and they come back and folks who move in, young folks who can afford it, these houses of rising rent, and they turn the whole neighborhood upside down. And folks, in fact, we got 8 wards in Washington, but now it's 9. PG County is Ward 9, and a lot of folks have been forced out of D.C. due to gentrification and other factors. What are some of the contributing factors that lead to this lack of affordable housing?
I mean,
I don't think the issue is as simple as gentrification. Also, before we move on to like the issue of the root causes of the homelessness crisis, I wanted to point out that when we're talking about previously incarcerated individuals who are experiencing homelessness in D.C., data from 2019 from the DC Policy Institute suggests that like 3 in 5 of the folks who are experiencing homelessness on our streets have a history of incarceration. And over half of them say that incarceration is the cause of their homelessness, right? So we're talking about gentrification or displacement causing homelessness. We're also talking about this prison homelessness cycle that is causing repeat homelessness or chronic homelessness. But we're also talking about a larger lack of prioritization and investment in the solutions to homelessness. There are people in the Wilson Building who are making very intentional choices about where resources go. And they're not recognizing these investments in building affordable housing, but also the programs that prevent and end homelessness. Those investments are investments in public safety. Those investments are investments in healthcare. Those investments are really crucial investments to make sure that folks are having the educational and work opportunities that they deserve that enable them to thrive in DC. So it's a really, homelessness is a really complicated issue. I wouldn't point to gentrification as the sole reason, you know, but it's definitely one of them, I would say.
Well, I didn't want to give the impression it was the sole cause. I know it's just one of many issues that contributed: low income, drug abuse, substance abuse, et cetera. The question is, what can be, you mentioned, Dana, that the folks at the Wilson Building, the city council members, they voted last week to increase the number of vouchers for homelessness. And I understand the mayor gated it or stopped it or rejected it. The Office of Marker, the mayor's Office of Returning Citizens, I think had 30 or 35 vouchers. Every week, 200 to 300 men and women are released every week or every month in this city. Over 3,000 people come back to Washington, D.C., homeless or looking for a house, and they only have like 30 or 35 vouchers. And the city and the mayor rejected this increase in vouchers. Are y'all aware of the mayor's position on these vouchers that the city council authorized to be disseminated? Go ahead, Andrew.
Yeah, we are. And Dana can definitely chime in here on this. So like my understanding of what happened most recently was, of course, so the mayor's initial budget did not include any vouchers. Correct me if I'm right, you know, wrong. Back in the spring. And so city council added vouchers in. They added 100 and roughly 150 for singles, for single unaccompanied adults. And then they added about 300 for families. So, and what's at issue and what has been in the news recently are these 300 for families. So one of the things that happened, to my understanding, is that when the mayor sent her budget over to Congress, she sent her budget and not the amended budget that city council had worked up. And now city council has to like put all of the amendments back in it before it goes back to Congress. But those 300 vouchers that they had in there, they had also made a cut to DCHA. And they thought that they would be able to fund these $300 because there was still money. DCHA still had money left over. But what got lost in all of the math, and everybody's pointing fingers at each other, is that that money that they thought was there for those 300 vouchers was actually there for last year's vouchers that haven't been connected to people yet, or actually wow. maybe have been connected to people, but haven't yet been utilized because the voucher process and getting from, like, you get connected to a voucher to into housing, that takes a long time, 3 to 6 months on average. And so, like, there was money there. And somehow, I don't understand. I don't know that anybody understands exactly, like, how that mistake was made. And so now everybody's scrambling, and I don't believe there's been a result yet about, like, can they get this money back for these 300 family vouchers? I don't know, Dana, if you want to check.
Can you explain, Dana, what the vouchers are? Because some of our listeners may not be familiar with what a housing voucher is and the program that Andrew just alluded to.
Sure. So there are several types of housing vouchers that folks can be connected to in DC, primarily at Miriam's Kitchen. We are a permanent supportive housing voucher, and those are vouchers for single adults or families who have experienced chronic homelessness for a number of reasons, right? Usually because there is some debilitating or disabling condition that makes it likely that they will stay in a cycle of homelessness. And so they need this sort of permanent support and these supportive services that come with it. And like Andy said, there initially from the mayor were no proposed vouchers in the fiscal year 2025 DC budget. And so it was through advocacy directly to the DC Council that we even have the few vouchers that exist now for the fiscal year. It's far less than what is needed. But it is the hard work of several council members who really were combing the budget to find money where they could to create that opportunity for, you know, we ended up with, I think, 148 permanent supportive housing vouchers. Data suggested that we needed 2,000 for this coming year, and we ended up with 148. Wow. But 148
out of 2,000?
148, but that's 148 more than Mayor Bowser initially proposed, right? And so we will take that win while recognizing that we have a lot more advocacy and work to do to make sure that there are enough vouchers for the people who need them. There's so many programs that were just underfunded. I don't want to focus solely on vouchers. We saw cuts across the board to housing solutions in this budget.
What kind of cuts are you talking about that just came out?
Sure. We saw cuts to the emergency rental assistance program. We saw cuts to homelessness outreach, which is really crucial in connecting folks who are living outside to local services and even connecting them to vouchers. And so, yeah, we saw cuts across those housing programs. We also saw cuts across the broader social safety net in DC. This was just really a budget that I describe it as it being imbalanced on the backs of people who need the most resources, right? There was an opportunity.
You're being nice, Dana.
I am trying to.
You're being nice, Dana.
Yes, exactly.
You know, because I just want to throw this in that we see you, if you're talking about the funding, the city government spent $29 million in the last year, 2 years, to relocate and house migrants. They gave $400 million to the business people downtown, Mr. Leonis and them. And the money's been, we're talking about the money's been cut or whatever. Then you got youth. I haven't heard no programs that's designed to go after the young teenagers or kids. Teenagers, 14, 12, 13, they're living in the streets. They're living in cars and buses and et cetera. Is there any program from the housing community that would address the needs of these juveniles and these young teenagers who are thrown in the street homeless?
I mean, I would say yes. I mean, Dan is a little bit more familiar with the overall lay of the land, but I can say, you know, specifically, you know, the housing, you know, so the homeless services, you know, continuum of care here in Washington, D.C. is basically divided into three systems. There's a single unaccompanied adult system, there's a family system, and then there is a youth system. So youth is like, you know, actual kids, teenagers up through age 25, right? Or young adults. The vast majority of the resources for homeless youth are transitional programs, right? They're not, there are a few programs for older youth, system aged people to get vouchers. And sometimes they are, those that are over 18 or 21 are handled through the adult system. And they do get connected to vouchers. And the other thing that I would say that I know is that, like, we now on the DHS Comprehensive Street Outreach Network's teams, we now have youth focused specialists, or like we are now specifically handling the youth. Previously, there was a separate team for homeless youth, and now they've embedded that into the three teams. And so we are like starting to do a little bit more direct engagement with homeless youth. But it's a really, it's a far more challenging population to work with, like on outreach, because they're not as visible. Like you don't necessarily know, and they don't avail themselves of services like
they
older folks
they
do.
Don't. Yeah.
You know, so it's a different issue. Problem or different presents different challenges, I should say.
Yes. You know, is there any program or organization that's specifically working on trying to target or locate these homeless youth who are roaming the streets? Some of them, last couple of weeks ago, we read in the paper that the truancy rate in Washington, D.C. for schools is 40%. So that means 4 out of 10 kids are not going to school. A lot of them don't have a home to go to. They don't go to school. They're in the street hustling. Their father's in jail. Their mother's in the street. And these kids, are there any outreach workers or programs geared to reaching or locating these youth who are just roaming the streets homeless and aimless?
I mean, I would say there are probably numerous, and ones that I don't even know about, but two of the big ones are the Sasha Bruth Youth Network and then the Latin American Youth Center based in Columbia Heights that deals specifically with homeless youth. And I'm sure there are lots of other organizations in the city who are trying to address the program. And now our DHS outreach teams, you know, we have specialists to work with folks who are youth aged. And that's it, you know, along those lines that I know of. But I also needed to chime in. I was reading an article yesterday that I saw that DC, over 6% of kids in DC public schools are homeless.
What percentage?
6%.
Six. I think it's a little higher than that. Yeah. I believe it's a little higher than that, because I see kids all the time, man, that we give them $10 or $20 to, and you can tell, man, that they're lonely, homeless, helpless, and don't have nowhere to turn to. So what would you suggest, Dana and Andrew, what could be done to address the homeless situation for the youth as well as for returning citizens? I'm waiting on you. Come
another
on.
Huge question. Another huge question from you this morning. Having a bad coffee. You know, Andrew mentioned two really powerful organizations in DC, Sasha Bruth Network, Latin American Youth Center. I also would add SMILE, which has been around for about 40 years working with LGBTQ youth. So investing in those organizations is definitely crucial to addressing, you know, the youth homelessness crisis here in DC, but also stabilizing families, making sure that there is truly deeply affordable housing built so that families can be stable, not face housing insecurity, not enter homelessness. It's a complex issue. And it requires investments from various different sorts of avenues. But definitely investing in those programs that already exist, investing in the creation of a targeting youth. And you know, I don't want to speak, you know, out of my league or out of my range. I don't work with youth at this point in my career, but I would just say investing in those programs that currently exist, because they're doing that really necessary work.
What do you say, Andrew?
I mean, I would definitely agree. And I think, you know, a lot of the situation is not, you know, not because there are bad parents, you know, but parents who are working 2 and 3 jobs just to keep everything together, right? And like, I know as a kid, you know, I grew up, my mom had 2 jobs, right? And I know the trouble that I got into, right? And I was one of the lucky ones, right? And so, you know, I think that that's part of the solution, like, you know, to provide better economic opportunities for folks, for parents, you know, who are trying to make a living and are just scraping by with multiple jobs. One call, you know.
Okay. This is WPFW 89.3 FM on your dime. You're listening to the Crossroads Radio Show. And our topic this morning is the housing crisis in D.C. And we have two gentlemen, Dana White, Director of Advocacy for Miriam's Kitchen, and Andrew Wasinick, Director of Policy. And we're talking about and exploring what the problems are about housing. Question, low-income families. Okay, wait a minute. Before I go, we got one caller on. Somebody's been waiting, and I can imagine who this is. He calls every month from Germany. I hope I'm wrong. Come on, first caller. You're on the air. Question or comment?
Good morning, fellas.
That's him. Everybody. I knew it was you, Rick. What they doing morning, in Germany, man? Let you call every Tuesday morning.
And I just want to say that I was blessed as a homeless man. In 1992-93, I met my wife at CC&V, 2nd and D. And back then, she had a little apartment that she was using to study Chinese medicine between Germany, New York, and D.C. And she let me stay in her apartment, and she covered the rent. But I was one of the few that were blessed. Tell me about the housing vouchers. Can you take a housing voucher and go outside of the district, Maryland and Virginia? Can you go west with the housing voucher and get away from the DMV?
Go ahead. Either one of y'all can handle that. Go ahead, Dana. You're starting.
I was going to let Andy take this, but my understanding is, first of all, thanks for the question. Thanks for the question, and good morning to you, or good afternoon where you are. But you can't take the voucher out of DC. Is that right? That's right, Andrew, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, there are a number of different vouchers that sort of like populate our system, right? A handful of them, some of them actually are federal vouchers, and those you can. And the general rule about those is that you have to use it the first year in DC, and then after that you can go somewhere else. Like that's my understanding. So there are some of them in our ecosystem, but the vast majority of the ones that we have are called local rent supplement vouchers, LRSP vouchers, and they are funded with DC dollars and they are meant to stay in DC. Now, we actually have a person with lived experience who's a part of our guest leadership, our guest advisory board that we have at Miriam's Kitchen of people with lived experience who advise us on the decisions that we make here at MK, who recently managed to get her local voucher transferred to a federal one, but I know it took her years of advocacy. And years and years of like standing up for herself and knocking down doors to get it to happen. In theory, it's possible, but it's not. I couldn't tell you how or.
Okay. Right. Do we have another call on, Mike? Our next caller, question or comment, please.
Yes, sir. How are you?
How you doing? You're on the air.
Okay. Excuse me, brother. I love your show. First of all, I just wanted to make a comment about the homelessness.
Come on.
I mean, this is a long-standing, ongoing, intentional creation. And it's aimed at Black people in particular. You know, we keep talking about homelessness, but these are Black people that, you know, worked to build this city since its inception.
Mm-hmm.
Built and designed all of these houses from 16th Street to the Potomac River. So the homes are here. It's about the politics of financing.
You said it, brother.
Who controls the money and who controls the idea behind the money that says we're not going to fund anything for these Black people? Matter of fact, if we pay them, they're going to be able to keep these houses. So we have to bring in immigrants. because if we pay them, they're going to keep these houses. We want to take all of these houses. This is intentional. When Marion Barry was in office, everybody had a home. I don't care if you were a bad person or a good person. I live next door to a lawyer on one side and a mailman on the other side. It wasn't about finances necessarily because the houses were made affordable. So this is an intentional taking of homes. This is not accidental. It's not a black man's fault or a black youth's fault. We blame ourselves a lot of times. And we say, oh, we got in trouble. We went on the wrong side of the law, the fence. No. These are intentional policies, and they hire people to do that. Now, I couldn't get a job doing that because I'm going to make it happen. I'm going to
win.
It's like, nah, you can't hire somebody like this man. Nobody like Barry. No, we got to keep them out of politics because they're fighting to win. We're going to hire somebody that's weak. We're going to hire somebody that's incapable of putting these programs over. Whatever happened to the after-school programs at the D.C., what is it, Parks and Recreation?
Yes.
Whatever happened to them? You know, we all had a park and recreation center to go to after school. None of that because, no, we can't give these youth nothing. They have absolutely no representation. And the people that are in charge of the money, what is it, the Financial Control Board or the Federal City Council,
mm-hmm.
Look at the people that are on there. Look at the lawyers. Look at these accountants and people that are on there. Look at their policies. Look at how they think. They're absolutely intentionally driving the black population in Washington, D.C. in the ground. And this is a long-standing problem. This is a long-standing thing. The mayor works for them. The city council is hired by them. They know how to manipulate politics. Trust me. They do it in the world, state, and they certainly know how to do it in Washington, D.C. You'll find out. I would say who these people are, but I don't want to tarnish your show because I know that's a hot
man, you ain't tarnishing my show. We're talking about being real. Keep it real. Come on with it, Jack. If you want to spill the beans, spill them.
The APAC lobby people, okay? They're young. And they're connected in practically every single industry there is. You know, there was, I'm talking finance, I'm talking real estate. You know, they'll keep you out of these houses. They're in charge at the D.C. Housing Commission. You look at who's in charge of these places and who set the policy. You come in there with the wrong mindset trying to look for a job to help somebody. As soon as they find out, oh, no, this is a black male with a family. Oh, you're out of here, buddy. They'll hire somebody from the LGBTQ community with no family, with no wife and no children. Put him in the job because he don't have no interest in dealing with no families. You see what I'm saying? They'll make them principals of schools in the Southeast. This is intentional, man. This is not a mistake. Ain't nobody making mistakes on vouchers. Who's making mistakes about a voucher? These people are very smart, very intentional in their efforts to drive the black community in the ground.
Okay, thank you for your question. We got a couple more guests. We'll let our guests We'll let our guests answer your question. Go ahead, Andrew and Dana. Y'all want to attack that?
Well, a lot was said there. What I will address is that. First of all, I just want to say that housing is a human right, right? It is the foundation of people's lives. Everybody, in my opinion, is entitled to have stable housing. That includes DC, that includes all across the country, any city, any town. What I will say is that I agree that there's a lack of political will to end homelessness. The resources exist. The money exists. The housing itself exists. There's a lack of political will to make it deeply affordable, to build more deeply and truly affordable housing, and again, to invest in the housing solutions that prevent and end homelessness. It's about people who have priorities and are making choices that are impacting, you know, the folks who have the most need, the folks who are the most vulnerable. And more often than not, that is Black Washingtonians. And so I think it's important to name race in this conversation. When we're talking about who's impacted by homelessness, not just in D.C., but across the country.
The country.
More yes. often than not, we're talking about Black people. And so this is very much an issue of race as much as it is of economics. So I appreciate that point.
Okay.
I want to be careful, though, to not suggest that there are, you know, different ethnic communities with competing interests. I think it's more about power at the top and it impacting the rest of us.
There you go.
You know, we have a lot of advocacy to do around that.
You want to try add something to that, Andrew?
No, I mean, I'm basically in agreement. And I think, you know, like there are intentional choices being made. You know, you're making a choice not to fund vouchers and, you know, making a choice to fund something else, or like, I'm going to make my cuts on social services programs and not somewhere else. So like, I mean, I agree that there's a certain amount of intentionality there. And I agree 100% that it affects Black and brown residents of this city and the country. African Americans are far more likely, you know, I mean, you know, nationally, they make up a 40% of, you know, the homelessness population, roughly. It's a, I don't know what the exact number is. And of course, like also overall, it's like 13%, right? So it's disproportionate amount. It affects African Americans and Latinos and Native Americans disproportionately to whites.
Okay.
Here and across the country.
So all right, thank you. We'll take our next caller. You're on. Y'all getting a lot of calls this morning, man. This is a hot topic. Next caller, please. Question or comment?
This is Roach Martin. This is Esther Williams Yarborough.
Hello, Esther Williams Yarborough.
How y'all doing? I want to speak, and I know you don't have a lot of time, about the missed opportunities. I live right up here by the bus barn on 14th Street, you know where it is, 14th near Decatur Street. And they are now rebuilding this huge facility for electric cars. We fought the facility for 25 years. They were going to bring back diesel. And we fought it with everything we had. And the only thing that changed them over was President Biden's edict to get rid of fossil fuel as much as possible, because they've been poisoning this neighborhood with diesel for many, many years. We have the records, the statistics that tell that a lot of people around here have asthma and that kind of stuff. I'm bringing all that up to say they're building this huge facility, and we have fought to get affordable housing added to it. Whoever was speaking before who said that there's no political will to get it done, that is the absolute truth. Why, if you're building this huge facility, is there not some affordable housing?
Along with it, that's right.
Why would that not be? And obviously, it is not a moneymaker for them. And we still fighting the fight up here, trying to figure out, we don't know yet. They're not open about the information that they're giving. They're really, really, they've been really clandestine and engaging in subterfuge. When we have our big meetings, we come with our questions and they tell us that they'll answer the questions later. In the meantime, this big facility is going up. It's disrupting all of the merchants on 14th Street there, but there's no affordable housing coming in there. It's as if the community does not matter. And this community was mostly Black, and now it's gentrified. That facility does nothing for this community, and they had the opportunity to do so.
Thank you. Thank you. Wow. Thank you.
That's awesome.
Either one of you want to address that?
Yeah.
Well, we have another call on, because I want to thank you, Esther, for calling in, because you hit it right on the head. We go up there to that up on 14th and Crittenden at that little restaurant, Highlanders, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I saw that big, huge facility that used to be the bus barn. So one of our guests said at the front, we're talking about politics, not politics, right. Politics. And the bottom line to this homeless, even if you solve the homeless problem, you still got another problem of employment. They got to raise, make money to even pay the mortgage. So we're talking about a problem that has many tentacles to it. And again, it goes back to, it ain't what you know, it's who you know. And we all know it's about politics. And the bottom line is, as you said, Dana, the least, the lost, and the less of us get left in the dust. And if folks don't do whatever they got to do, even when we elect somebody in and they tell you they're going to do this, they get in there, man, and turn into sideways and give me some more Juggie Boogie. We're talking about City Juggie Boogie. Juggie Boogie from the mayor, Juggie Boogie from them people who got the money and the resources, and the little folks are dying, being crushed. The same thing we're talking about is happening over in PG County. We live in Merlin, Martine and I, and we're going through this problem with all over the city. Do we have another caller on a mic? Come on, we'll take our next caller. Boy, y'all got a lot of callers coming in this morning, Dana. You're on the air, please. Question or comment?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I actually am a recipient of the LRSP. And then ironically, I was...
What's LRSP?
That's the local rent subsidy program.
Okay.
And right. I have a unique perspective in that I'm actually a broker that was brought up to work on behalf of the USPS, was brought here, used for the minority component, and spit out alongside my family and ended up homeless. So I will say that I have offered up suggestions, being a recipient and a broker, to how they can modify the program in a way that actually makes it functional. And the caller that called before the lovely Esther Williams was absolutely 100% correct in that there is mountains of Juggie Boogie that actually...
You're my kind of lady.
What do you mean by you are a broker? What does that mean?
Literally a broker. So the post office called me up to work, unfortunately, underneath a subcontractor, JLL, and extremely racist experience. And I was saddened in that many of those jobs, you know, I was excited to work for the post office because I grew up in D.C. So many of the families that I knew were able to ascend from lower to middle income as a result of those federal jobs with the post office. So there was a level of pride in taking on the role of a transaction manager on behalf of the post office. However, there was a lot of politics involved. They actually, you know, took over a lot of the jobs that the post office used to do for itself. They privatized those positions. So I was under one of the subcontractors who had another agenda. And unfortunately, like I said, I was used for the minority component and spit out a year to the date of my hiring, resulting in me becoming homeless. So me and my family, my two children. So I actually was a recipient of the LRSP, know the program. And when they changed recently, the recent changes with the standard operating procedure where HUD scrutinized the use of the vouchers. There were a lot of assumptions that were made about the vouchers not being used properly, as in many of the owners or the capped amount being presented in a way that would somehow hyperinflate the rent market. You'll hear people on the west side of town, because this is a very polarized area, they will assume that as a result of the rent subsidies having a certain cap in certain areas, that we are somehow involved in encouraging those rents to be hyperinflated. And we now know that there's a big lawsuit that is happening on the federal level where these algorithms have been used to manipulate the rent rolls. And I think that you all have been following that. Hopefully at Miriam's Kitchen, where, you know, there's going to be a lawsuit about the reason that in most of the majority of the cities, the rents have become so impossible for anybody to pay is right. because of price fixing, essentially. So that is being looked at the DOJ level. And it was assumed that somehow voucher holders who have nothing to do with the rents being the way that they are, for example, you used to be able to put in a zip code if you were looking for an apartment and it would say, okay, you're in 2004, based upon 2004, three bedroom, your voucher will allow you to pay this as a maximum. So when you would go to the landlord, for example, speaking to the standard operating procedure, you go to the landlord and you say, you know, my voucher will pay this amount. And then you have to hope and pray that a landlord will accept you. And they say, oh, no discrimination, no discrimination. Yeah, there's discrimination. Because once they find out you have a voucher, they're going to decide if they will or will not accept you. So the recent changes that they've made will allow a lot more people to end up homeless, even with the voucher. You know, the program is, yeah, it's been manipulated in such a way that it's going to be almost impossible to use the vouchers. So if you have a voucher and you're going from the, what do they call that? The rapid rehousing, which is a program that is to prevent homelessness temporarily. So someone could have a rapid rehousing voucher, get accepted, move into a place, and then be expected, as you see many of the families, I think there are 1,200 families that are about to be kicked off of rapid rehousing.
1,200?
Wow.
Yeah, I believe the number is around 1,200. And I would speak to Andrew about that. Andrew, is that number close to correct, that is 1,200 of rapid rehousing families that possibly could be kicked off of rapid rehousing?
Yeah, that is true. And like that's one of the what makes the kerfuffle around those 300 family vouchers like an even bigger issue, because they were put into the budget with the knowledge that this program was coming to an end, and it was to help sort of like buffer the transitioning of those 1,200 people to different resources. I mean, a lot of them are getting stepped up to vouchers, and the hope is that none of them end up homeless again. So we need to come to a solution, you know, we need to make sure that those 300 vouchers like still come through if at all possible.
Okay. Let me thank you for calling in. We're running out of time and we got 3 minutes. Andrew, you want to take the first minute and a half, and Dana, about what can be done to deal with this housing situation? If you was in charge, no, forget that. Give us some closing remarks, how to get in touch with you and what can be done to fight this housing problem. You got a minute and a half. Go ahead. You got it, Andrew. Start off.
Well, I mean, we're probably going to echo each other, but whatever I miss, like Dana can say. I mean, I think the main thing is that we just really need to make sure that we're funding these housing voucher programs to the degree that they need to be funded, that we are also addressing the inflow to homelessness. Like we've talked about the criminal justice system leading into homelessness. That's one of the major feeders of homelessness. We need to cut those inroads out, because if we're cutting vouchers, then more people are heading into homelessness and unsheltered homelessness, and outreach
in
teams
and
shelters are overrun and they can't but handle so many, you know, people that we're seeing on a basis. So we have to fund these programs you know, robustly to make sure that we're that nobody's being left behind, and hopefully in the future, you know, make it a point that we're not balancing budgets on the backs of poor folks.
Okay, thank you, Andrew. Go ahead, Dana. You got it. You got a minute and a half, Dana, for closing.
Sure. So I would say, you know, I think what's on all of our minds right now is that we need to vote, right? But voting is not enough.
Yes.
You have to hold these people accountable. You have to hold their feet to the fire. You have to show up at the Wilson Building and testify about your experience. You have the right to meet with your council members. You can plug into the work that we're doing with the Way Home campaign at thewayhomedc.org or on social media at the Way Home DC. There are also some partners in this work. Fair Budget Coalition is a great coalition that's working on the budget more broadly beyond housing. I'm talking community safety, investments in education, and so forth, because housing is one part of the issue, but it's not the only issue that we're facing as working class folks in the city. Yeah, you know, have these conversations with your neighbors, organize the tenants in your building, hold your landlords accountable, but show up at the Wilson Building, call the mayor, email your council member. There are so many ways to plug into this work, not just vote.
Thank you. Thank you. Our guest has been Dana White, Director of Advocacy for Miriam's Kitchen, and Andrew Wasinick, Director of Policy at Miriam's Kitchen. Thank you both for this enlightening, stimulating conversation. We'll be inviting you gentlemen back again. This is Roach Brown with my wife, Mertine Moore Brown, at Crossroads. And thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you again next Tuesday. Remember, your inner voice is never wrong. Merry Christmas. Pick it loud and pick it sound. Don't punish me with brutality. Come on, talk to me so you can see what's going on.
School is back. Do you need an after-school program for your young one? The Words Beats and Life Academy is enrolling for students from third grade up to young adults, with programming weekdays, 3:30 to 6 p.m., offering classes in hip-hop performing and visual arts, as well as business and arts leadership, with access to professional teaching artists, equipment, and resources. Located in Columbia Heights, Northwest Washington, D.C. at St. Stephen's Church. Classes are always free. Enrollment at wblinc.org/academy, based on availability. The fall session begins September 9th. We hope to see you or your young one there at the Words Beats and Life After School Academy.
All right, all right.
Remember, wblinc.org/academy.
Jazz musician Herbie Hancock and his band, featuring Terrence Blanchard, graced the stage of the Warner Theater on Friday, September 27th. Info available at warnertheater.com.
This is attorney Nikechi Taifa, and I am thrilled to host a talk show entitled Human Rights and Justice. Join me every Wednesday, 5 to 6 p.m., starting September, as I feature insightful commentary and stimulating guests discussing domestic and global themes encompassing political, economic, and social rights. Get up and stand up with me, Nikechi Taifa, Wednesdays, 5 p.m., for human rights and justice.
Attention, jazz and creative music fans. On Friday, September 27th, New York meets D.C. when pianist Matthew Shipp's trio performs on a double bill with Washington's own pianist and bandleader Janelle Gill and her trio at the NYU campus in downtown D.C. Matthew Shipp will also stick around after the concert for a question and answer session with the audience, moderated by Bushmeat Sound System, a.k.a. Dr. Thomas Stanley. This concert on Friday, September 27th, is presented by Capital Bop. Tickets and more info can be found at capitalbop.com. That's CAPITALBOP.com.
WPFW's This Is Reggae Music and the Reggae Experience presents a fundraising concert featuring Image Band, Curlew Reggae All-Stars Band, Lady Flame, and Carl Malcolm. On Saturday, October the 5th, 7 p.m. until midnight at King Solomon Lodge, 2245 Rhode Island Avenue, Northeast Washington, D.C. Tickets available at Eventbrite by searching WPFW. All proceeds benefit WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Bethesda Theater presents Spyro Gyro, celebrating their 50th anniversary on Sunday, October 13th, and Norman Brown on Sunday, October 20th. More information at BethesdaTheater.com.
Hey, Chris Garlock here.
And I'm Elise Bryant.
Every week, we explore labor arts and culture
on the Labor Heritage Power Hour.
Thursdays from 1 to 2 p.m.
right here on WPFW 89.3 FM. That's the Labor Heritage Power Hour.
Thursdays from 1 to 2 p.m.
The heart and soul
of the American labor movement.
Hi, this is Tom Cole, host of G-Strings here on WPFW every Sunday morning. I and the rest of the station's volunteers and staff would like to invite you to join the WPFW Legacy Listener Circle by making a contribution to the station's future through your estate plan. There are a lot of ways to do that, through your IRA or retirement plan, by gifting us life insurance, or through your donor-advised fund. We'd be happy to have a confidential discussion with you as you consider a planned gift to the station. Please reach out to us at planned.